Good morning. There's kind of a wonderful image that kind of develop when you've spilled a cup of coffee on something, isn't it? Yeah. Last week, we were talking about deciphering the inner voices of the ancestors. And I shared with you a story that I had written about what I consider a very major dream for me. It was perhaps one of the first nightmares of my life as a boy around 6 or 7. And what we did with that story was, it was just one version of many. Of all of our dreams, of all of our stories, whereby we are looking for the book. We are looking for the sacred language. We are looking for a way to articulate and verbalize experiences that every one of us have. The experiences themselves are not unique. I think what we are probably trying to do is to search for a language of the heart that describes the experiences that we are having, and we're needing validation for that. And I think that's why a lot of us are searching many of the different kinds of sacred scriptures. We are searching the Bible. We are searching the Upanishads. We are searching the Bhagavad Gita. We are searching Native American traditions. We are searching everything we can get our hands on so that we can see what our experience is about and attempt to validate that experience. Because it is important, if you will, isn't it, to have some form of guidance through the word, through the written word, through the spoken word, through the gestured word. And so that's what deciphering the inner voices of the ancestors last week was all about. A way of attempting to make that very difficult and dangerous journey out of our family of origin, the journey toward God, to look at how our divine parents are our ultimate parents, but also to honor and revere and claim what the ancestors are also saying in us, because they have great courage and they have truths to tell us. Not only the ancestors that are written out there, but the ancestors within ourselves, those ancestors that we come out of genetically. But we also come out of the original parents, the divine father and mother, and we are returning to them. And this is the great decade where we're becoming aware of the necessity to gather as a human community on this planet with one mother and one father, one divine mother and one divine father. And it's a wonderful time to be alive. Today, what I would like to speak with you about is this age-old problem that we seem to be having no matter what era we get born in, and that is the problem of balance in our lives. And it seems to me these days, wherever I'm looking, I seem to be running up against or running alongside of or greeting balance. And so today the lesson will be entitled "The Passion of Balancing and the Balancing of Passion." Okay. Because I think when we talk about balance, sometimes we can get mired in stillness, stuckness. We can get mired in mediocrity, because our versions of balance seem to lack luster in life. Does that make sense? I mean, how can you tell an adolescent or someone who's growing, you know, up about balance? It sounds very boring. I remember the first time, in fact, my wife Allison reminded me of this, the first time our family got a car with power windows. And the kids were in the back seat going, I'll beat you. They're having these races with who would get the power window up and down, right? And they were going up, down, up, down, up, down. I'll beat you, I'll beat you, I'll beat you. You know, pushing it down, right? And then pushing it back up. And of course, the parents are going, oh my God, yeah, turn off the whole thing. Let's turn in the car. That's because there's so much life in youth. And you can't tell, you know, folks who are very, very young, who are kind of growing out of themselves by the second and by the minute, you know, about something like balance. So I guess it comes a little bit with age and with a little bit of wisdom. But wherever we look, there is balance that looks back at us, I believe. For instance, in the four elements, earth, wind, fire, and water. Big John Cornelius was telling me recently, he was reading from Earth Prayers, that wonderful book, Prayers of the Earth, that all the world religions get exemplified and get portrayed through their wonderful descriptions of the divinity of Earth. Big John tells me of the importance of wind. That without the wind and without the air, we would suffocate. Without the wind, we would become toxic with our own poisons. Without the wind, we would not have cleansing. Without the wind, the forests would not be cleansed of their leaves and branches. It is no mistake that spirit in all ancient languages means wind, breath. And the spirit breathed over the waters, even Genesis says. The importance of wind. And yet if there were only wind, we would be scorched. We would be dried up. We need the balance, don't we? We need water. And yet if we only had water, we would drown. If we only had water, we would shrivel up just as much if we only had wind. And fire. The necessity of fire. And yet if there's too much, the earth is consumed. And we can keep going with this, with these images of the four elements, the four major elements of the world, right? Without earth, we need earth indeed. We need soil. But if there were only earth and no water or no wind or fire, life could not go on. And when there is an extreme of one or the other, it seems that something goes out of whack. Imbalance. Sherry Armendariz writes about summer being a time of fire. She says, summer, a time of fullness, a time of excess, a time of heat. Heat so intense it becomes fire. The distortion is excess. Summer is a time of excess, and we need to be careful. She says, as I protect my body with food, I cover my skin from the unrelenting scorching heat, and I shield my heart from the heat of anger and fear, and guard my summer machinery with oil and coolant. All is protected, guarded, and in balance. She says balance, clients, friends, and family are all walking that tightrope between depletion and excess. I thought that was very, very well put. And perhaps in summer it is the time of excess. I've been trying to get in touch with why I'm getting so angry on the highway. I mean, I am a type A personality anyway. But I seem to be getting more angry in the heat of the day. You know, I don't know how y'all are feeling about this. What's going on? But it's like, I think because there's so much concentrated heat. The heat of the engine, the heat of the sun, the heat of the highway, the heat of speed, the heat of summer. All is heat. It's an illusion. It can distort reality. We can almost hallucinate. Because it doesn't show, we don't even see reality in its clarity with too much heat. Right? Just like the person in the desert who can see the mirage. We don't really see reality as it is if we just get in touch with heat and get in touch with fire. There seems to be a lot of excess going on. I was just reading the paper this morning. Did everybody read about this small fruit dumped under federal order? In Reedley, California, millions of tasty, nutritious peaches and nectarines originally bound for low-income consumers in central Los Angeles are being destroyed at the order of the U.S. government. Why? Because the peaches are not meeting U.S. regulations. They're not big enough. Only a computer can even define which are the large enough peaches for the consumer. The actual growers and pickers cannot tell the difference. Each week, Mr. Garawan, whose family is the largest peach and plum and nectarine growers in the world, each week his workers dump 100,000 pounds of forbidden fruit on an unused dirt road where it is left to rot in the blazing sun. No one can eat it. It says most people, including trained pickers, cannot tell visually that the fruit fails to meet the size standard that requires an expensive weighing and sorting machine. And the answer? Well, Mr. Garawan right now is in court. Because he's violated federal law by selling the undersized fruit. Talk about being stuck between a rock and a hard place. The Growers Committee are saying that, well, one must act in the best interest of the majority of consumers, and consumers are prepared to spend more money for larger fruit. Isn't this an outrage? When I was reading this morning, This hit home, you know, so I might get into the abstract a little bit today, and I understand. We kind of go to planet Saturn and end up on Earth by the end of the hour, hopefully. But I think sometimes we do have to go on a journey in order to understand our home place, right? We do have to go on a journey to understand our home place, just like the awe that the astronauts had when they took off from Earth and then looked back on the planet, on that wonderful, marvelous sphere. And all of a sudden felt an almost incomprehensible love. And at the same time realized that they existed. In some way we have to leave home in order to realize the magical, marvelous, wonderful identity that we have. And so I think it's important to sort of get dropped in the sea of what is, so that we can understand perhaps what is possible. And it's hard, isn't it, the art of not losing perspective of seeing the big picture. It's difficult. It's very, very difficult. And I think that's the art or the challenge of balance. The four seasons tell us, don't they, summer, winter, spring, and fall, about balance. It seems that we need to... Something's wrong. We're not looking at nature and learning from nature. It seems that if we're guilty of anything, it's not learning the lessons that nature silently teaches us. That somehow we are missing the very core and heart of ourselves because we are not listening and really looking. Right? I mean, how many of us, when we're in our cars, you know, I mean, the air condition right now is so cold, it's like we could hang meat in here right now. I really don't even know how to turn it down. Right? When we're driving on the streets, I see people running, right? Blasting music in their ears, you know, as the birds are singing. We're out of touch. Or those of us who are compulsively, you know, we're trying to exercise and we're not understanding the rhythm of nature, and we will overheat. It seems to me that the test is in the balance. So I'm going to be talking about a lot of things that kind of occurred to me in terms of imbalance and the necessity for balance in our lives. But the four seasons. If we only look at the four seasons alone, if you're having a problem with understanding a spiritual program, knowing the four seasons is very important because the seasons change. And there's no problem with things dying because they recur again. But for some reason, we have a difficulty of letting go of what we hold so dear. But the four seasons have no problem with this. Right? The tree has no problem with being pruned and recycling and dying and being born again. But we have such a problem, don't we, of letting go of what we are attached to. Loving what we are given, but letting go. And letting life reoccur again. We have such a difficulty with this, it seems to me. And even those of us who have the illusion of stability, we have a problem with allowing our relationships even to grow and change, don't we? And allowing our friendships to grow and change, rather than just getting new ones because the old ones won't play our games. Right? Be it a wife or husband or friend or brother or sister. Allowing ourselves to change. And yet even the four seasons must have a higher power at their base. Because if there was only change, right? If there was only change, we wouldn't have that eternal return back to what we see as familiar. Isn't it true? That's why our hearts are so struck by the spring and summer and fall and winter. Because we remember. We remember the beauty of each of these. The four directions, north, south, east, and west. Without a center, we would have no direction. And the four directions bring the rain and the wind and the heat, the fire and the ice. Up and down. Some of us only want to go up, you know, but we have to go down. But if we only go down and don't go up, we're at an imbalance. How about loving home, leaving home, making home, returning home? The balance of this. Freedom and intimacy. How many of us, if we only want freedom and we're only wanting space, we can get in an imbalance? However, if we only want intimacy, if we only want connectedness, we will be at an imbalance. We will be unhappy. Freedom, intimacy, connectedness, and yet a sense of having a self. It seems that many of us go here and then we go there, right? And we don't have that dialogue between the two of a balance. We get angry when someone encroaches and impinges on our freedom. Sometimes it takes years, right? For instance, the mother. I've given everything. I've given all of my life. And now what? Right? Or the father who's given everything to the corporation and now wants something for himself. The balance, it seems to me, unfortunately, tragically, we learn sometimes, not, I won't say too late, but we sometimes learn at a time, you know, where we won't be able to enjoy it. Because we're always shifting and testing out the extremes, aren't we? So freedom and intimacy is another road that we all... I'm tempting to name some of the things that we all know already. But, you know, how to maintain the balance. How to maintain the balance is oftentimes a mystery. Between change and stability. If we're constantly changing and have no stability, we'll be out there in left field, right? Irresponsible. Totally detached, isolated. However, if we're only within stability, if we only are doing what we've always done, we'll lose the life of the Spirit, right? Especially when other people tell us what we need to do. How about spontaneity and discipline? I don't know about you, but when I hear the word discipline today, I still kind of get the... You know, it kind of gets me a little angry and I get a tick, you know, when I hear someone tells me discipline, you know. Discipline has a... There's a way that somehow it rings, discipline, it just sounds so harsh. Right? And we want to learn spontaneity. That word, spontaneity, it's like I just kind of... I go out of myself when I say the word spontaneity. Discipline. But, you know, the balance of the two is so crucial. It's so crucial. Discipline, disciplinare, the Latin we all know probably means to follow. To follow. So what are we going to follow? We have to follow some kind of program, some kind of routine, but we don't want to totally snuff out spontaneity either, right? And then if we do spontaneity only, then we're at a loss. So discipline, I think the only way that discipline is ever going to work, it seems to me, is through love, the love of following. One has to have some kind of vision, though, I think, for discipline to really have a lot of passion and fire to it. One has to have some kind of vision, some kind of purpose, some kind of meaning. One has to be in love with something or someone. Isn't that true? For discipline to really work, because it has something to do with commitment, right? It has something to do with daily stuff. And one has to have some kind of vision, some kind of purpose, or discipline only becomes routine, mechanical. And we can dry up, right? And we can get very, very resentful with just discipline. But spontaneity, you know, just spontaneity is pretty scary. When we look at our own past, you know what I'm talking about. To look at our own past and see these incredible impulsive movements of ours that were spontaneous and yet had no responsibility to it or no commitment or no vision. It was just sort of spontaneity for spontaneity's sake. And yet we still grow even we do that too. I think most of us probably only grow by testing out the extremes. Until we get so tired of doing that and we experience so much pain in testing out the extremes that now we go, okay, life, okay, all right, I'll listen, right? And then about a week later, we start feeling stronger and then we do the extremes again and then life kind of trips us up and we fall and we go, okay, all right, this time, I'll listen. Okay. After 2 weeks goes by, I mean, human beings, it's amazing. It seems that we never really learn this until we, you know, we can't walk. We've missed a leg. Half our brain's missing. You know, our lungs, you know, we've smoked ourselves to death, right? You know, we do so many things until finally nature goes, you would have been a lot happier if you learned the lesson of balance. Thanks. But it's, for some reason, our will, our willfulness, Bill W. says our self will run riot, seems to go against this wisdom of balance. Doesn't it? This wisdom of balance. And then balance can be kind of just balance is dynamic. Balance is not only sort of standing still and doing nothing. Right? We have to always be moving to be in balance. Because if I'm still and doing nothing, what's going to happen? The world will pass me by. The world will be going against me here, shoving me aside. Right? I'll be passive, a victim. So balance is never about only standing still, it seems to me too. It's always about moving. But then when I'm moving, I'm risk-taking because am I going in the right place? Right? I'm thinking of a patient who recently asked me, Neil, if I challenge my belief system and my values, if I challenge this, what if I'm wrong? To challenge my belief system and value system and try another way of looking at things. What if I'm wrong? And those people that are telling me, this is the way you have to do it, what if they're right? Some of us, we really want spirituality insurance, don't we? We want spirituality insurance. We want to be able to do some things that are certain, so just in case they're wrong, whoever they are, we'll have some spirituality insurance. I think we may need a nursery here pretty soon. We're starting to have a majority. This is great. I mean, it's wonderful to have babies and children and everything here, but it's great. A lot of... I think they call it a balance. But there's always a barometer. Children give a barometer. They're bored. Adults probably are too. I mean, it's like, you know, if they're not understanding, adults probably aren't either. If children are sort of mesmerized and enchanted, chances are what whoever is speaking is saying something that makes sense. It's difficult. It's really difficult to be betwixt and between and not get a headache. To be betwixt and between and not get a heartache. It's difficult to be betwixt and between in the midst of change. And attempting to constantly restore the balance when we lose a balance. Restore the balance, lose the balance. How about reason and faith? Well, I want to be able to prove it. God exists because. Look at the harmony of the universe. Right? Reason and faith. Or how about faith? Have faith, trust, don't ask any questions, close your eyes, don't use your mind, just have faith. That doesn't work either. You need a balance between reason and faith. Losing self, finding self. We enter the arena of paradox too. I have to lose myself to find myself. Isn't that true? We have to lose ourselves to find ourselves. That's why, especially in the beginning, I think in our recovery, we need to do anything we can to lose ourselves appropriately. What in the heck does that mean? Well, you know what I mean. I think you know what I mean. Losing ourselves means giving up control a little bit. Giving up the reins to some kind of recovering group or process. And see what kind of wisdom that will bring. And then all of a sudden we find ourselves. Probably many of us lost ourselves emotionally years and years and years ago. And the birth of a self is almost the birth of the emotional self. And we talked a little bit about last week, the birth of the spiritual self. How many of us have been spiritually incested, for instance? To be spiritually incested means that from the very get-go, our being, our vision, our feeling, the way we saw things was unvalidated, and somebody said, you have to do this, this is the picture. We were spiritually incested. Or someone who goes, I wish that you had the Lord Jesus, like I do. Or the Jew who says, you must live the law, and I know exactly what the law is, and if you don't live it the way I am living it, you will go awry. Right? Or the family that looks at the son and daughter and says, if you are successful, you are a human being. If you are not successful, you are evil. We are spiritually incested. So at such a young age, it seems to me. And we're not allowed our vision. Solitude community. I bet you, some of you, if I have another group, I'm going to throw up. If I have to go to another meeting this week, on the highway, you have to stand in line at a movie. Fast food is even no longer fast food. I think I was in line at Wendy's for like 45 minutes yesterday. I mean, Christ, I could have gone to a French restaurant and eaten before that. There's a yearning for solitude, and solitude is important, but if we have too much solitude, we'll isolate, we won't be connected. Solitude community. It's important to meditate and pray, and to do that alone, but it's also important to connect to the community, to test out the meditation and prayer, to test out the vision, right? To achieve that balance. Solitude doesn't mean isolation or being totally disconnected. And community doesn't mean that I always have to be with people. Right? I mean, God forbid that Sunday I might have an hour alone. Some of us have anxiety attacks about that, about the weekends, because maybe we'll spend some time alone. Right? Especially those of us who are single. Oh my God, I've got to have something to do Saturday and Sunday. Especially workaholics have a very tough time being alone. Excuse me. Very tough time being alone, and also a tough time being qualitatively, emotionally present with others. It's all of a balance, this notion of solitude and community. Blocks to balance, quickly. The block to balance, I think, is any of us saying one or the other is important, is more important. Solitude is more important than community. Right? The word is more important than action. To say that one is more important than the other, that one must be hated or destroyed even, happens. And that's a block, I think, a block. The block is in the lie. How about one-sided clarity, the small picture, false security, losing the large perspective, the foolishness of the naive young person, and the fear of risk-taking on the part of the old. These are blocks. The mixed message, which breeds lack of trust, right, early on. I think that's an incredible block to the notion of balance, the mixed message. You know what I mean by the mixed message? It's, of course we love you. Many of us receive some mixed messages when someone said something, God loves you, of course. You know, as we've just lost our job. Or we've lost a person who we've loved, a mother or a father, and someone tells us, well, it was God's will. The mixed message. God loves you unconditionally. Yeah, but what about other people? The mixed message. Whereby someone says something, but by their gesture they mean something else. And so if we learn very, very early about the mixed message, we will lack trust. We will lack trust because we don't have ourselves as a barometer. Because very, very early on, we realized that there were people of the lie who did not get honest with us. For instance, all I think I really needed was a parent to tell me, I'm really scared. I don't know if I've got it all together right now. Okay? Sometimes to achieve the balance, we have to be true and honest. And that's how the balance begins. Okay? That's the importance of being honest. If someone just simply told me, if the teacher raised their hand and said, I don't know the answer, I'll look for it. Rather than giving us the answer and we thought, I don't know if that's really true. You know? I don't know if that's true. We want clarity so much and we want the truth so much that we're blinded to it. Isn't it true? And it seems to me that truth is betwixt and between. It's in Heraclitus' river that we cannot step in twice in the same place. We can never step in the river twice in the same place because the river is always flowing and the water is always different. And we may look and say, oh, isn't that the wondrous river? Isn't that the marvelous river that I fished at or sailed down yesterday? It's a different river. It's difficult. This betwixt and between, this restoring of the balance. But it seems to me spirituality gives the perspective of always needing to sort of restore the balance. Okay? Perhaps that's what spirituality is constantly restoring the balance. And don't forget, restoring the balance without giving ourselves so much pain. You know? Because most of us, how do we arrive at the balance, as I said? We risk living the extremes until the pain and harsh lessons of living out of balance teach us, finally, maybe. How about the ancients like Heraclitus, Buddha, Jesus, Gandhi? Guess what? Everyone lived the extreme until they found the balance. Everyone lived the extreme until they found the balance. And then what they did is then they wrote down, or someone heard their traditions and then said, okay, you need to live a balance. Right? Jesus was constantly balancing. Constantly balancing. Right? As the scribes and Pharisees come up and talk to him about theology and ask him all these important questions, what did he say? Look at the child. They inherit the kingdom of heaven. They were out of a balance. Right? Have the trust and faith of a child. When the theologians of his day were saying, let's talk about clarity and abstracts and intellectual stuff, he was saying, wait a second, we have to get balanced here. Right? Buddha, he went to every extreme until finally realized that the only way we can arrive at truth is by living the middle way, right? Gandhi, with his experiments with truth, did the same thing. Harsh, harsh fasting and asceticism, attempting to have a spiritual bypass to achieve nirvana in 2 weeks, is impossible. You know, you may realize that it was the middle way. The middle way. So even the ancients tell us, the sacred masters tell us, it's in all the writings, there is a time to laugh and a time to cry. There is a time to mourn and a time to be joyful. There is a time to plant and there is a time to reap. Right? This sense of balance, all of the scriptures can tell us, they tell us about it. But it seems to me, doesn't it? I guess this is the sense of humor, the good news that I give you today, is that most of us are going to have to let life teach us harshly and with a lot of pain. But even so, we will learn the balance, finally. And we will be brought into the gathering of joy where there is no judgment. So I guess the bottom line is, if we have to live to extremes, it's okay, life will teach us. I guess what I would wish for you and wish for myself is if we let the masters teach us, right? If we let the ancients teach us that perhaps we can live a life of balance without giving so much pain to ourselves, life would be a lot easier. Wouldn't it? As Jesus told us, my burden is light. My burden is light. But it seems that we don't learn this until we are given a lot of crises. And that's okay too. And maybe this can give us some compassion to love one another, even though they're living the extreme. And not to enable the extreme, but also not to judge it harshly. For in the end, all is love. in the end, all is compassion. Let me end with a quote from the Buddha. A man walking along a high road sees a great river, its near bank dangerous and frightening, and its far bank safe. He collects sticks and foliage and makes a raft and paddles across the river and reaches the other shore. Now suppose that after he reaches the other shore, he takes the raft and puts it on his head and walks with it on his head wherever he goes. Would he be using the raft in an appropriate way? No, says Buddha. A reasonable man will realize that the raft has been very useful to him in crossing the river and arriving safely on the other shore, but that once he has arrived, it is proper to leave the raft behind and walk on without it. This is using the raft appropriately. In the same way, all truths should be used to cross over. They should not be held on to once you have arrived. You should let go of even the most profound insight or the most wholesome teaching, all the more so unwholesome teachings. And let's balance, because this is about a man. Now, Buddha tells a story of a woman, and we'll end with this. As a mother at the risk of her life watches over her only child, so let everyone cultivate a boundlessly compassionate mind toward all beings. Isn't that beautiful? Last week we talked about the passion of balancing and the balancing of passion, part one. And I guess what we discovered last week was the fact that for the most part, most of us are continually going in and out of balance, constantly losing balance and constantly regaining it at most. And this is ideally. Now, many of us find ourselves in the world, in life, at a particular point in our life, we find ourselves totally out of balance, not knowing how to regain it, in fact, not even knowing if we are out of balance or not. But even when we begin the process, the long life continuing, perpetual process of recovery, I believe we are always going in, losing balance, and regaining it. And that is a very, very human quality. So balance is not a static thing. But it is a thing that we are dynamic. It's not even a thing. It is a dynamic, a process by which we are learning how to become mature emotionally, mentally, spiritually. But what we did not talk about specifically was how we know when we are out of balance and how do we arrive. How do we get into balance? How do we practically become balancing selves in our life? And that's what I would like to speak about today. So I guess we could call today part two in the passion of balancing and the balancing of passion lecture. First, I'll begin with a definition, a working definition, and then we'll take it into parts and really try to ask the question, what can we do to find out whether or not we are out of a balance, and then how can we seek practically to gain it? How do I arrive at balance? It seems to me by thinking, feeling, and acting from a higher good, a higher truth, a higher beauty. Let's just begin with this very simple working definition. How do I arrive at balance when I am thinking, feeling, and acting from a higher good, a higher truth, a higher beauty. It's very easy to look at this definition and discover when I am out of balance, right? If I'm doing too much thinking and not enough feeling or acting, I'm out of a balance. If I'm doing too much feeling without thinking or acting, I'm out of a balance. If I'm doing too much acting without thinking and feeling, I'm out of a balance. If I'm not doing enough thinking, etc., etc., not doing enough feeling, not doing enough acting, I'm out of a balance. But there is another dynamic I think that is at work here, is that some of us are thinking, feeling, and acting in unison toward a very lower good that can be destructive. Okay? So sometimes thinking, feeling, and acting can be working in unison, but for a lower good. And that's why I think is it important to say that arriving at balance will be thinking, feeling, and acting from a higher good, a higher truth, a higher beauty. Certainly we can look at addiction. And, you know, in the action of using, one can see very much that thinking, feeling, and acting are in unison, but highly destructive. Does that make sense? Well, let's take thinking first. Thinking in a balance. What does it mean to think in a balance? Or thinking our way toward balance? Or finding out through mind where we are in the continuum of losing and regaining balance. How can I check myself? Let me suggest that first, perhaps being true and honest with myself is the way that I begin to think toward a balance. Being true and honest with myself. Am I in denial about a hurt or a sickness I have been hiding from myself or others? That's another question we could perhaps ask. And it's not only mental sickness or physical sickness or even a genetic sickness like chemical addiction. But even physical sicknesses, ever like postpone the doctor because we don't want to find out something, because we might not be able to go on our vacation, or we may not want to face something that we're feeling or intuiting inside. Just recently, a client of mine was thinking about going on vacation and not going to a doctor when she knew intuitively that something was going wrong inside of her physically, and thought, well, I don't want to ruin everybody's time, so I won't go. Maybe I won't go. I don't want to ruin everybody's time on vacation, and I don't want to ruin my own. You see how that's thinking out of a balance? Because what I'm doing is I'm conveniently in a state of denying the truth about myself, whatever that truth might be. So there are particular things we can do. Do I find myself rationalizing a lot? Then I'm out of a balance in my thinking. In other words, am I making excuses a lot to others to justify my behavior? Chances are I'm thinking out of a balance. And when I think out of a balance, what will occur is hurt, is pain. Now we all know that we're going to experience hurt and pain by living in this world. The child who cries when they are first born, when he or she is first born, we know beyond the shadow of a doubt that pain and suffering is all a part of coming into this world and probably going out of this world and living through this world. But don't you think that many of us take on pain that we don't need to? By, for instance, even continually making the same mistakes, the same patterns, the same thought processes, we continually bring a lot more pain and suffering on ourselves than we actually need to. So I'm not suggesting that some kind of, you know, new age, well, if we all think and feel and act in a balance, nothing wrong will happen to us. I think that's a very imbalanced belief. And I think we can get into a lot of problems thinking that way, because what happens if I'm living in a balance and bad things happen? Which will occur. Things will happen. I'll get sick. I'll bump into things. I will. I'll get hurt. I'll make mistakes. I'll sometimes be rejected. Things will happen even though I'm in a balance. But I will not experience as much pain, as much suffering, as much travail, I believe, if I'm working in a balance. That's what I'm suggesting. Am I seeing things in black or white? Confused a lot? I'm out of a balance in my thinking. Do I have a direction, a goal, a purpose, which is fitting to my dignity, no matter how small the task? If I do not, then I am thinking out of balance, and it is a dangerous place to be. Am I using a lot of energy to lie and distort the truth? Am I covering up? Am I living a double life? Am I one person here and another person there? I'm usually living a double life if I'm doing a lot of covering up and excuse making and using a lot of mental energy to distort the truth of myself. Do I jump to conclusions? Do I listen without judging too quickly? Do I spend a lot of time projecting a self to others, one which I think they will like? A false self, an approval-seeking self? Well, I answer questions if someone asks because I think that's the answer they want. And if I give them the answer I'm really thinking, I might not get the prize. I might not make the sale. I might not have the friend. I might be rejected. Do I know if I'm asleep or awake, even though I'm walking around? Where do I put the energy of my thoughtfulness, my mindfulness? Am I putting that energy in something I want to possess, or a person I want to possess, or something that I wish to do, even though I may be bringing hurt upon myself? Do I like to make things clear, even though I may be blind to a more difficult truth? These are some questions that we can ask, I believe, ourselves to check whether or not we are thinking out of balance or in a one-sided way. The Chinese master Chuang Tzu, in 369, well, he lived between 369 and 286 BCE, before the Common Era, at some point between these two dates, he said the following. He said, heaven is the great equalizer. That spoke to me of the force or power which can get us into a balance might actually be heaven. Brings us into a balance. Now, heaven, as Chuang Tzu understands it, of course, is a place of being, of equanimity, of poise, of uniting opposites. It is an earthly happening, heaven. Chuang Tzu, the great master like Lao Tzu, was always trying to include the two opposite and complementary aspects of a truth which logic wants us to choose between, Stephen Mitchell writes in The Enlightened Mind. Chuang Tzu said, "The person of wisdom embraces things. Ordinary men and women discriminate among them and parade their discriminations before others. So I say, those who discriminate fail to see." And he says, "Someday there will be a great awakening when we know that this is all a great dream. And yet the stupid believe they are awake." This is speaking to me these days. The stupid believe they are awake. Isn't it true? We go to one family workshop. We do one kind of sculpturing exercise and family rules. We begin to recognize what we have been denying for many, many years, and we realize we have been asleep, even though we have been standing up and walking. So I think... Chuang Tzu, I don't know if I'm understanding you correctly, but it seems to me that this kind of dream awake state that he is talking about is my not really understanding how much of my behavior, beliefs, and thoughts and values are determined, and I walk around blindly choosing from those beliefs, feelings, thoughts, etc. You see? I'm blind about it until I run up against the cosmic wall. Now, there are many cosmic walls that one can run up against. Treatment, for instance, is a cosmic wall. A cosmic wall might be losing a career or job that we depended upon is a cosmic wall. A relationship, going to pot, and I thought it was absolutely fine, is hitting up against that cosmic wall. Living my life, doing everything for everybody else, my mother, my children, my father, everybody else but me. And all of a sudden, I wake up and realize how depressed and hurt and sick I am physically, mentally, and spiritually, and ask, wait a second, what is wrong with this picture? That's running up against a cosmic wall. Enabling all of those people who we do not wish to hurt by the truth, by mindfulness, and finally they and me get hurt. That's running up against a cosmic wall. Birth, giving birth to a child is a cosmic wall. Death is a cosmic wall. The life issue that keeps cropping up and finally crops up so much that I am stilled. I am paralyzed because I have been denying and avoiding this life issue. This is what I think Chuang Tzu is talking about. And so it's not any kind of tricky kind of language, really. It's that we probably are sleeping the whole of our life until finally we awaken. We awaken with the knowledge of what we have been doing to ourselves and one another, and we haven't had a clue. We have been living the great sleep. I think perhaps that's what Chuang Tzu is saying. So the how-to of thinking toward a balance has a lot to do with simply becoming honest and allowing ourselves to move through the self-deceptions, beginning to recognize and admit that I've been asleep all of these years. That I've really been asleep to what is actually the case about my life. And perhaps spirituality, before we can even begin to uncover the pearl of great price that is at the ground of our being, we have to deal with some of these lower issues and awaken to them. I wanted to read something by Chuang Tzu, which is wonderful. He's quite a humorous bodhisattva, master of knowing the self, like Socrates or Jesus. And this is a wonderful way that he came to this balance of mindfulness and thoughtfulness. He says the following: when great nature sighs, we hear the winds, which, noiseless in themselves, awaken voices from other beings blowing on them. From every opening, loud voices sound. Have you not heard this rush of tones? There stands the overhanging wood on the steep mountain, in old trees with holes and cracks like snouts, maws and ears, like beam sockets, like goblets, grooves in the wood, hollows full of water. You hear mooing and roaring, whistling, shouts of command, grumblings, deep drones and sad flutes. And one call awakens another in dialogue. Gentle winds sing timidly, and strong ones blast on without restraint. And then the wind dies down. The openings empty out their last sound. Have you not observed how all then trembles and subsides? A great master replied, I understand. The music of earth sings through 1,000 holes, and the music of man and woman is made on flutes and instruments. But what makes the music of heaven? And Master Divine Breath said, Key Spirit, something is blowing on 1,000 different holes, and some power stands behind all this and makes the sounds die down. What is this power? This seemed to me to kind of level all of what we attempt to know about. And basically, I think all Chuang Tzu is doing is he's saying, for us to really know about what balance of mind is, we have to observe and feel and see what is going on with the wind in nature. And that all of them are true. And there is not one that is false, but all have their place. But in nature, all seem to be doing it at a time at which they need to. And Chuang Tzu says, well, if we learn, because what is going through us, what is blowing through us, the wind of the Spirit, which creates words, which creates songs, which creates scriptures, which create all sorts of gestures, blows through 1,000 holes, through many. And Chuang Tzu says, don't get so excited. I think what he's trying to say is, we shouldn't get so excited when we hear one of those voices, because they are all part of the unmanifest, the hidden, the unnameable higher power. And if we look to that higher power, or highest power, as the source of all of that expression of music that blows through nature and blows through man and woman, then perhaps we will understand and begin to understand how to get out of the imbalance that we are in when we rationalize, when we minimize, when we are in denial, when we don't want to hear the voice, right? Because we are afraid, but that gets into feeling, etc. Okay? So it is important, I think, when we think toward a higher good, a higher truth, a higher beauty. You see how generous that is in expanding rather than a lower good, a lower truth, a lower beauty. Okay? Now feeling. Feeling in a balance. Do I under or over identify myself with a feeling? For instance, I'm angry. When I say that, I'm saying I am anger. Or I hate this or that suggests that all of me hates something. How about I am afraid? or I am hungry. These are really false. We need to be careful not to over-identify with feelings. Because the bottom line is, I feel anger, right? I feel like I hate this because of this. I feel fear. So, we can over-identify with the feeling. We need to name it and identify it, but we can over-identify. And we can also under-identify, right? Oh, I don't feel anything. That doesn't bother me. When in fact, it can bother me greatly, right? Neil, you sound defensive. I'm not defensive. Neil, you seem angry this morning. I'm not angry about a thing. What are you talking about? And we can under-identify with the feelings we need to. So what am I talking about with feeling? The balance needs to, you know, not over-identifying with the feeling, not under-identifying with the feeling, but naming it, sharing it, letting it go. Oh, how about the negative feelings that develop into attitudes? Attitude. The character defects, right? Step five. That's what, you know, feelings develop into attitudes, I'm discovering about me, unfortunately. The feeling that develops into an attitude is one that I just can't kind of, well, okay, I let it go, I name it, goodbye. You know, I'm in total serenity now. The attitude is a kind of feeling that gets in a groove and plays a song, you know? Plays such a deep song, a deep groove in our mind, in our software of our psyche, that it is very, very difficult to sort of erase it like we can do on a Mac or IBM. Okay? Am I pessimistic? That's an attitude. We can ask ourselves, just ask yourself, am I resentful? Am I prejudiced from an early experience or feeling of hurt or fear? Boy, you know what I mean? Am I prejudiced because of an earlier experience or hurt or fear? So I don't like a particular group of people, or I don't like to go to this place, or I don't want to eat this kind of food because I had one or two bad experiences or feelings. An attitude of prejudice. We will be out of a balance in our feeling. Are you with me? We will be out of a balance in our feeling. do I fly off the handle? Apparently you don't, Smitty. You were laughing when I said that. Do I fly off the handle? Oh, am I indirect with my anger? Do I get angry but project a false self? Indirectly, I'm real angry. Do I hurt myself by self-condemnation or others by shaming? That's indirect anger, okay? If I condemn someone, that's indirect anger. Or if I condemn someone when they're not there, we call that gossip. That's indirect expression of anger. We are out of a balance in our feeling. Do I punish those I presume to love by withdrawing love? You see the feeling? You see how the distortion comes about? Am I generalizing to others when they hurt me with statements like, "You always do that," or "Why can't you ever do this?" Do I shut down out of fear when I'm afraid to know the truth and try to figure out what someone is feeling rather than asking them directly, "How do you feel about this?" It's amazing. We're incredible storytellers. We could all be highly published if we put these things down. You know what I'm saying? We tell ourselves so many stories because we're trying to feel what someone else... It's, you know, the high, high superior level codependence is when, you know, I know what you are feeling and I respond to how you are feeling. I don't even know what I'm feeling at all. Am I afraid to express my anger and frustration towards those I respect, admire, and love? Even God? See, I'm out of a balance with my feeling. If I'm really feeling something, but I feel like I can't do that because if I do, someone will be angry, maybe even the divine. Oh, God. So I have to sort of, you know, lie to my inner self, and you know, because many of us, I think, you know, I find many clients coming to my door with anger towards a higher power for many reasons. And I believe we need to get honest about that, or we're going to stay in the imbalance of our feeling. You know, if you say, well, I shouldn't do that because that's not what one should do. Well, I don't care about shoulds. If it's happening, let's get to the imbalance of the feeling. Right? We're apologizing for the behavior of those who we respect and love because we don't want to hurt them. And we're not being true to our feelings, are we? Do I spend most of my feeling energy reacting to how others feel about me rather than truly connecting with how I feel at a particular moment? Do I ever allow fear to be my higher power? I believe it was an Aztec Indian who, to me, says it the most simply. He or she, I don't know who Menantonquat is, okay? But it is a very, very, it's an extremely wise saying that I found in this wonderful book called Earth Prayers from Around the World. And it talks about love is all there is, ultimately. And all other feelings is the only feeling there is ultimately. And all other feelings are but twisted and distorted versions of love. Isn't that wonderful? All other feelings that are not love are twisted and distorted versions of love. Can I read this to you? I don't care if you want to let me. I'm going to read it anyway. Oh, humankind, are we not all brothers and sisters? Are we not the grandchildren of the great mystery? Do we not all want to love and be loved, to work and to play, to sing and dance? But we live with fear, fear that is hate, fear that is mistrust, envy, greed, vanity, fear that is ambition. We're talking about feelings and attitudes here. Competition, aggression, fear that is loneliness, anger, bitterness, cruelty. And yet fear is only twisted love. Love turned back on itself. Love that was denied or love that was rejected. And what is real love? This Native American says, love is life. Creation, seed and leaf, and blossom and fruit. Always going to nature. Always going to nature. Fruit and seed. Love is growth and search and reach and touch and dance. Love is nurture and succor and feed and pleasure. And love is pleasuring ourselves, pleasuring each other. And love is life, believing in itself. And life is the sacred mystery, singing to itself, dancing to its drum, telling tales, improvising, playing. And we are all that spirit, our stories, all but one cosmic story, that we are love. And perfect love in me seeks the love in you. And if our eyes could ever meet without fear, we would recognize each other and rejoice. For love is life believing in itself. Isn't that beautiful? So all the feelings that are not love, this Native American says, are simply distorted versions of love. You see what we're talking about in terms of balance. In terms of balance. But we need a higher love in order to really allow us to see, I believe, the lower aspects of love. And finally, action. We're talking about thinking, feeling, and action, living in harmony toward a higher good, a higher truth, a higher beauty. Action. Do I find myself being stuck? Indecisive. Incapable of making a decision. Or wildly acting without thinking at all. Compulsively. impulsively, all those ulcerations. Am I willing to accept the consequences of my actions? If not, I'm acting out of balance. Can I take responsibility for my choices to act without blaming myself or others if I make a mistake? Do I not act out of fear of failure or fear of success? How many of us don't act because we fear failure or we fear success? If we're acting out of this fear, we are acting out of a balance. Do I react rather than respond to the call of a higher power for me to be creative, innovative, and healthfully risk-taking? Have I lived out and tested important recurring dreams, those tales that might be told about my life? What am I saying? Have I tried that sport or taken lessons to play that musical instrument? Have I learned how to operate that, they call, user-friendly computer? Can I be spontaneous without trying to control the plans of what might occur when I go to a meeting or a gathering or some kind of social event? Am I afraid of discipline and shun the need to do the small tasks daily? Can I find love in the ordinary by doing a small thing well? Can I get out of myself by being compassionate? And can I be with someone who is suffering or dying without having to control the outcome? We're talking about action. Do I have a good, sharp sense of knowing when to act and when not to act in order to experience the work of a higher good, a higher truth, a higher beauty? Do I recognize and value the importance of the process and not only the goal? Do I pay attention to the means by which I arrive at a desired goal and not only the goal itself? Do I lack courage when I see someone's character being hurt or disgraced, whether that person is present or absent in a group? Can I rise to the occasion and act with courage for myself or for others? Jesus of Nazareth said, "For the measure by which you give is the measure by which you shall receive." And Lao Tzu said, "Act but do not expect." And Gandhi, when asked about his compassionate politics, said the following: "I am here to serve no one but myself, to find my own self-realization through the service of others." And the Tao Te Ching, perhaps Lao Tzu, said, "Care about people's approval and you will be their prisoner. Do your work and then step back. The only path to serenity." Isn't that amazing? I mean, that sounds like the 12 steps to me. It sounds like program stuff. You know why? Because it's folk wisdom. And I really believe we need to recover the folk wisdom to gain balance in our lives. Pure and simple folk wisdom. Folks from all nations, from all countries, from all walks of life, give me the wisdom by which to live toward a balance, always losing and yet always seeking to regain the balance.